Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Harriet F. Senney. She is a professor emerita of art history at the City College of New York and at CUNY Graduate Center. She co-founded the international organization Public Art Dialogue. And we're talking about her new book, Monumental Controversies, Mount Rushmore, Four Presidents, and the Quest for National Unity. Harriet, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
This book is about the national monument, Mount Rushmore, to start with. But it's also about monuments of the four presidents that are carved on Mount Rushmore: George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, and Theodore Roosevelt. But then it's actually part of a larger discussion on unity in America, valuing inclusiveness, and I would say the reality and complexity of history. This book accomplishes an awful lot in a few pages.
Well, thank you for that. I would like to just introduce the notion that it didn't start out as a book about Mount Rushmore at all. It began because of my experience on the Mayoral Commission in New York, which was formed in 2017 in the wake of all the concern about Confederate memorials after. And one of my takeaway from that experience was really the inability, and these were 19 professionals, you know, wasn't man on the street, although sometimes those people, or woman on the street, sometimes those people do better with these things. The inability to think in terms of and rather than or. In other words, Teddy Roosevelt was a good guy and a bad guy, not or a bad guy. And my experience on that commission, when I dared to suggest there might be some reasons for keeping the equestrian memorial outside the Museum of Natural History, really, it became very toxic in there, let's just say it that way, and several people apologized to me afterwards. The level of that intensity was really what was on my mind when I began thinking about Rushmore, because those four presidents of late have all become attacked for one thing or another. And I thought, everybody knows Mount Rushmore, right? So that would be a good vehicle to maybe try to get from or to and.
And I find that that's a very difficult thing right now in America.
Oh, my God.
Nobody's thinking left, right, or center about that. I mean, the idea is it's all or nothing.
And it's a moral imperative on all sides.
Yeah. And these monuments are definitely focal points for these arguments. They're not discussions for these arguments. And let's start by talking generally about Mount Rushmore. And a lot of people have probably no idea what the history of Mount Rushmore is about. The first thing I want to ask you is, why is it in South Dakota?
Oh, it's in South Dakota because the state historian, Doan Robinson, there wanted to attract more tourists to the area. The Black Hills are very beautiful, and he thought it would be good for the local economy to attract more tourists. I mean, truly a very extreme of beware of what you wish for, right? But in any event, he had in mind something very local. He had some Native American chiefs in mind, local heroes. That all changed when Guts and Borglum, the sculptor, came on the picture.
First of all, one of the great names in art, Guts and Borglum. Now,
you can't make it up, but it's in South Dakota because of the state historian.
The problem with Mount Rushmore is it's problematic on several stages of its creation. First of all, let's talk about the Lakota Sioux.
They own that land. There is no question about it. It was ceded to them in an 1868 treaty, which was then violated, and it was obviously never restored to them. At some point in the much more recent past, they were offered a monetary settlement.
And they refused it.
They refused it because for the Lakota Sioux, the land is like our mother from which we derive all nourishment, and it's not for sale.
In your book, you have an entire history of treaty violations with the Lakota Sioux.
Oh, it's
and I'm just
really
laughing because it's insanely bad. I mean, if people don't know this, they should read your book just for that. I mean, it's just amazing. There's a treaty and then it's violated. And there's a treaty and then it's violated. So there's a whole background history of the people who originally lived in this country, of them getting the land snatched away, and obviously hard feelings on their side. Gutzon Borglum is a problematic person. He's a white supremacist.
He's problematic on a good day. He is very extreme. He's both evidently was incredibly charming and truly awful, not only in his beliefs, the white supremacist and an anti-Semite. There's some debate whether he was actually a member of the Ku Klux Klan, but he certainly supported their policies. Not only that, he was very loosey-goosey with money. He traditionally overspent, which obviously gave his patrons a lot of problems. And the commission that he was working on before Mount Rushmore in Atlanta, Stone Mountain, a Confederate monument, he overspent drastically. The board had had it with him. He'd had many warnings. And when they told him the commission was over, even though it wasn't finished, he had a real hissy fit. He smashed the model, and he was chased out of town by his sheriff. He went straight to Mount Rushmore because in the meantime, Don Robinson, who knew that he could do large-scale commissions, had gotten in touch with him. I mean, it's truly like something out of a Western. I don't know.
Yeah, he is not a good person, but he knew how to schmooze.
Totally, because he kept getting supporters. He kept getting these huge commissions.
Why does this sound familiar to me?
Really. Some of the things that I found out about as I was putting this book together, researching it, I thought they're alarmingly relevant, right?
That's everybody I've talked to about this book, that's exactly the two words that they've used about this book.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear it.
Now,
it really does
this, the heads of the four presidents was not his original design.
Well, it began with the thought of being just two. Washington and Jefferson, and then the other two were added because actually, I mean, we think of it, maybe not you and I, but many people think of it primarily as a monument to American democracy.
Mm-hmm.
But really what Borglum had intended was a monument to American expansion. And so Washington, of course, began, and he was interested in more and more land, no question. Jefferson increased the country by over half with the Louisiana Purchase in 1803. Lincoln kept it from coming apart, and Roosevelt expanded our national boundaries in terms of his what we would definitely call his imperialism. So that's the underlying theme, but that's not the one we get taught usually in school.
No. Excuse me. Originally, he was going to have the whole bodies of the president.
Yes. That, can you imagine?
Oh,
I mean,
God.
The heads are big enough. I forget how tall they are, but they're enormous. That proved to be impractical, to say the least. And, you know, this is a major accomplishment to carve these huge heads into a mountain. Sometimes we forget that that's really a very big deal. And I've spoken to several curators of sculpture who were, you know, really impressed, and that's all they talk about, as opposed to all these other things that we're chatting about now. And I think that's important to keep in mind.
I want to get back to the Lakota Sioux and things like the Trail of Tears and the Battle of Wounded Knee. Wounded Knee, which is a flashpoint for the Sioux, the Lakota Sioux, is not that far from Mount Rushmore.
No, it's not, and I'm hard-pressed to think about the actual distance now in miles, but that was really another one of those really dreadful, dreadful occurrences where initially Custer and a group of his men who were looking for gold in the hills that belonged to the Lakota Sioux were attacked by some of the Native Americans. And in retaliation, the army came out and really did a mass slaughter of the local residents. It was really atrocious. And some thought that that might be the end of the Native American presence there, but happily that has not been the case. But it's been a long, hard, ongoing fight to get back some recognition of what is rightfully there.
Borglum was also adamant about the exclusion of Native American people.
Yes, and women. For a moment, there was a strong push to get Susan B. Anthony up there, but there are a whole slew now of cartoons of people who wanted to get up there, including our last president.
Now, there's a Crazy Horse Memorial.
Yes.
Can you talk about that? You describe it as having disturbing ironies. Why is that?
Well, first of all, Crazy Horse and Native Americans in general do not approve of or believe in these large-scale monuments. So, and Crazy Horse evidently was reputed to be a particularly private individual. So to have this enormous, enormous sculpture, which is still incomplete, as a tribute to him, is really inappropriate, shall we say. That said, it's become a kind of personal family moneymaker.
Why do you say personal family?
I'm sorry, I'm spacing on the name of the artist who did it, who trained with Borglum, got into a fight with Borglum. You know, he joined the line of people who got into a fight with Borglum. And then he went off, and on his own, he started building this memorial. And his children have since become involved with building it. And you can go visit it, but the fee is exorbitant, and all the fees go to the family. The federal government at one point had offered to take over the management of it and make it some kind of a national monument, but the family refused.
One of the things there's so much more about Mount Rushmore, but I want to move on to other things before the show's over. But one of the things you do talk about is how different presidents since then have sort of made speeches in front of Mount Rushmore and have tried to utilize it for their own. George H.W. Bush, Clinton, Obama, and Trump have all used Mount Rushmore as a place to give speeches.
Because it's, you know, it has become, it's really, to my mind at this point, a national monument, second only perhaps to the Statue of Liberty. And one gets enormous amount of ambient political power, I think, from standing in front of it. But if one looks at the different ways it was used, one can see a certain expression, if you will, of individual politics.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Harriet F. Saney. Saney, excuse me. She is a professor emerita of art history at the City College of New York. And at the CUNY Graduate Center, she co-founded the international organization Public Art Dialogue. And we're talking about her book. It's a really important read and also an interesting read. Monumental Controversies, Mount Rushmore, Four Presidents, and the Quest for National Unity. One of the things that you do in the book is you take each one of those presidents and then you talk about other monuments to them. And by doing that, you also sort of bring up all the problematic issues with those four presidents. And it seems that part of the problem is we learn a very narrow, single-minded point of view history of our country. But each one of those four presidents there had problems with Black Americans and had problems with Native Americans and a lot of other problems too.
That's absolutely true. And I think the real challenge that we're facing today, and it's a huge challenge, is how do we reconcile, for example, the fact that they all were racist in their own way. Some evolved away from that position. Some became more accepting of slavery. Jefferson was an example of the latter. Early on, he had written a treatise really opposing slavery, but gradually, as his life and his economy was dependent on it, he kind of, you know, kicked the ball down the road and hoped that future generations would, in effect, make it go away. And I think that that is really hard to think about. Now, Washington took a different direction. Washington never spoke out loud against slavery, but he began towards his later life to try to make plans to free his slaves after his death. And in fact, that's what he did in his will. He said that all his slaves should be free upon Martha, upon his wife's death.
But he never made a public plea for emancipation.
Never, never. But he obviously was troubled by it for a very, very long time. I always found that particular provision a little bit strange because Washington was an extremely pragmatic guy. I mean, he led the armies in the Revolution, et cetera. Martha freed her those slaves at once, right? Her life would have, you know, been in a somewhat compromised position with slaves waiting to be freed until she died, right? But nevertheless, and I really want to emphasize this, he did free them in his will. The only one of his time to do something like that. And additionally, he did provide for training for slaves who had not been allowed to go to school or trained for anything except what their masters wanted them to do, and even some provisions for care for the elderly. And the reason that those provisions are so important, especially the training ones, is it indicated that he did not think that blacks were innately inferior. He really recognized the fact that their inabilities to maybe make a living at this point in time were a function of their not having been taught to read or not having been trained in any specific trade.
Was it two of the presidents there thought that the best solution to the black Americans was to send them to another country like in Africa?
Yes. Even Lincoln, for a while, believed that. He even said that. I'm laughing because it was shocking to me. I've had, just as an aside, I've had several friends say to me they learn more about American history from
exactly
this book than they ever had in school. And I always tell them, so did I. Because some of these things were really surprising to me. And this particular aspect of Lincoln, again, he evolved. And he evolved, obviously, in the right direction. But he actually had a group of blacks at one point in the White House, at which he said to them, you know, you guys aren't, you know, you guys are inferior to us, but we really want you to do well, and we think you'd do best if you went to the Caribbean or Africa. Now, he also changed his mind after he met Frederick Douglass. But yes, he believed that, and that colonization as a policy, was supported by some of the most revered politicians of the time.
I always find Teddy Roosevelt one of the sort of the odd president out in that monument.
Yes, and also, you know, Borglum also was friendly with him.
Oh, okay.
Which, you know, it's how it works, right? But I think the thing about Roosevelt today is that we remember the bad more than the good, whereas
that's, right.
That's not true about the other three. He was a great advocate for labor and anti-big business. He also imposed tests for government workers. He didn't believe in cronyism. And I just discovered recently, very recently, this is not in the book, that on one of his hunting trips to Buganda in Africa, which was actually the model for Wakanda in the recent movie, mm-hmm. It's a democratic nation, and he was so impressed by this that when he came back to the States, he made it a policy of his campaign for president. Unfortunately, he didn't win. I say unfortunately because the history of the racism in this country might be somewhat ameliorated had he won, but it really started me thinking along the lines of, you know, we're always asking the question, what if Lincoln hadn't been assassinated? And now I'm starting to add to that question, what if Teddy Roosevelt had won in his last bid for election?
I also want to mention he was huge on conservation.
Yes, huge. Absolutely. He did more for conservation than any other president before or since. I have a laundry list of how many parks and this and that.
But and then on the other side of the tally sheet, he was also a huge imperialist president.
Absolutely. And even for his conservation, he often took those lands from Native Americans.
That's right. And that brings me to the final discussion I want to have about moving towards a more inclusive national narrative. This is the point. The point is not to have all A or all B.
Right.
But to have A and B.
Yes. Now, how we do that at, let's say, at our memorial site is problematic. And I don't have a hard and fast answer to that. Obviously, I thought about it quite a bit.
Have they tried at Mount Rushmore to be more inclusive about Native Americans?
At one point, the National Park Service director there, I think it's called director, was a Native American, and they did include more information about that, but he was only in charge for a number of years and was replaced then, I believe, by a white woman. I don't know who's there right now.
Is part of this
so
the way that...
That was a long yes.
is the answer then the way history is taught in schools too?
Yes.
I grew up in the 50s and everything was all the positive things that everybody ever did.
Right. And I don't know how much that is the case now, but we know there's this huge, huge push to ban books even mention racism or slavery or anything negative about the United States.
Don't get me started.
It's completely alarming. I think that there is a push to go back to that if it ever went away.
But it's ironic because, as you mentioned and you write about in this book, all four of those presidents were also about national unity.
Every one of them was worried that we weren't going to hold together as a country. Washington, in his farewell address, made that a major theme. I was particularly struck by Jefferson after he had won an extremely contentious election, saying, okay, I've won. We've all got to come together now, and we have to listen to people who have a different point of view because that's a hallmark of democracy. That's my most alarmingly relevant observation about the quest for national unity. Of course, Lincoln was all about it, right? I mean, once we get to the Civil War, we don't have a union without Lincoln. Roosevelt wasn't plagued by that so much, but in his election campaign, his campaign button had the word unity right over his head. So we have to assume that he is still thinking about it and that it is still a major issue, but not as perhaps concerning as it was for the earlier president.
Is part of also when these monuments, and there are many mentioned in your book, including the St. Louis Arch, is part of it that information at the site be put in there so that people can get a full picture?
I would think that would be a very positive place to start. It will still make people angry. There's some people who really don't want to hear anything negative about these presidents or this country. So I would say if there were a way of making this information available but not hit you over the head and make you read it if it's offensive to you, that would be the way to go. What form that should take, I'm not sure. I mean, I think there's a lot to be said for the oral programs that the National Park Service rangers provide. I think there's a lot to be said for linking to online information, maybe everything that we can think of. I think it would also be interesting to involve artists in discussions of what alternative monuments might look like at this point in time. I think there are a lot of ways to go.
What's interesting is this is also an international situation, too.
You know, absolutely.
And I think it's been around for a long time. When I think about all the Roman emperors that, and when they're lost and they're murdered or whatever, people would smash their sculpture and then put up new sculptures. So we've been dealing with this for a long time. At the end of the book, though, you have a tremendous list of the things that divide the country and a discussion underneath. And it's amazing. Jefferson was adamant about the separation of church and state.
Yes, he actually wrote a treatise that was largely influential at his time because he was largely influential. And the fact that his, you know, last public contribution, we might say, is the formation of the University of Virginia.
Right.
Where there still was slavery, but one presumes that freedom of religion might have been something that was conveyed through the classes. So how we get away from this at this point in time, it might be helpful to bring that treatise back out and quote Jefferson. He was a very smart man.
It's a complicated issue, and the great thing is that's what this book is about, is by accepting the complexities of our national history. My guest tonight is Harriet F. Saney. She's Professor Emerita of Art History at the City College of New York and at the CUNY Graduate Center. She co-founded the international organization Public Art Dialogue. And we're talking about her book, which is a really good book to read. If you're looking for something this summer, this is it. Monumental Controversies, Mount Rushmore, Four Presidents, and the Quest for National Unity. Harriet, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
You listen to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.